Hey, so on the way in, maybe some of you, hopefully you got one of these. These little, I mean, this, the art on this is incredible. We didn't actually generate this art in-house. But this is a little secret decoder ring, if you will, to understanding some of the major symbols in the book of Revelation. And so we'll be going through these each week. We're not going to print them off each week because that would be incredibly expensive with all this color. So if you like, put this in your Bible, bring it back with you next week, that would be awesome, and we'll refer to that from time to time. I'm just so happy to be here with all of you. You all are the best. I never would have imagined that I'd be here today. I don't just mean because like I grew up hundreds of miles away in Detroit, Michigan. Sometimes I go, how did I get here? I don't just mean that. I'm happy and in some ways shocked that I'm here with you today because as a kid, this isn't hyperbole. As a kid, I never thought I would even live to make it to adulthood at all. And you go, Paul, what do you mean? Okay. So I grew up in a church context that was really, really, really into the end times. We talked about the end times all the time. Before school, there was a local Detroit end times evangelist that I would watch before school. I won't say his name, but... And every week, it was the same format. Here's something going on in the headlines. You know, I'm a elder millennial, so most of it had to do with like the end of the Cold War, the beginning of the first Persian Gulf War. And this guy would connect the news headlines to biblical prophecy from Daniel and Revelation. And this guy, without skipping a beat, like he probably had the whole Bible memorized, right? He could fire off verse after verse, and he was connecting it to current events. And always, the message, recurring message each week was, the end times are like now. It's going down right now. And here's what's going to happen. So you watch Russia do this, and then you're going to see Saddam Hussein do this, and it's all connected to the Bible. And as a kid, I legitimately thought, I'm not being hyperbolic here. I did not think I would make it to my 20th birthday. Some of you are looking at me like, that sounds terrible. I've explained this to my kids before, and they're just shocked. Don't worry, I'm not scarred by this. I've worked through a lot of this with a therapist. I didn't imagine I would make it to adulthood. Maybe some of you can relate to being in that kind of environment where all the, not just that local TV show, we had this entire developing, burgeoning ecosystem of movies and stories, Christian movies and stories revolving around the end times, right? You know, I'm actually kind of pre-Left Behind books. I mean, I remember seeing Fire in the Night and, you know, a bunch of these end times movies about the Antichrist and all this other stuff. And frankly, it was pretty terrifying as a kid. And all of this shaped in me this, I could not envision life beyond into adulthood. I just kind of hoped I would make it to get married. That was really it, as many youth group boys could attest to. Where did that entire ecosystem, this entire ecosystem of prognostication, where did that come from? You know, as we delve into the book of Revelation, you know, when Pastor Jay brought up in this past summer, he's like, hey, I think at some point I kind of want to work through Revelation. Some of those past traumatic experiences welled up within me, and I was like, oh, I don't know, Jay. Not because I didn't trust Jay. In fact, Jay is probably the best guide. Last week's sermon, if you weren't here, you need to go back and listen to it or watch it. It was outstanding. I totally trust, and we are on the same page and all this stuff. But it did bring up feelings for me about, oh, man, going back to that place of thinking about these books again. But I'm really excited because as a church community, one of the things we want to do is take, if that was the mode of engagement with Revelation you've had in your past, we want to take you out of that entirely. This is not the way we're going to be engaging with the book of Revelation. And in fact, the way that many people have first encountered this story and this book is built upon a flawed misunderstanding of the genre of the book of Revelation, and a misguided hermeneutic approach to the interpretation of Scripture. Again, we'll talk more about that at the Discovering Leaders track at the end of the month. But what it ended up doing was kind of assuming our questions that we bring to the text is inspired instead of the text itself. So I go looking for figuring out, how's this Cold War going to end, or who's going to win the Persian Gulf War? And I go looking to the Bible. I'm thinking my questions that I'm bringing are inspired. If I need to extract out of there what will come. That is not how apocalyptic literature worked. As Pastor Jay talked about last week, let's review a couple foundational points before we get into today's message. A couple foundational points with review here. Remember, Revelation is certainly for us, but it is not written to us. This book was originally written in the first century, explicitly stated to seven churches located in Asia Minor. It is to them first. Is it still for us? Absolutely. But we need to understand that God first inspired an author to communicate truths to that time, that culture, and that audience. And guess what? It wasn't a mystery to them. They weren't thinking back then, I wonder if this has to do with like nuclear holocaust and the end of the Cold War. They don't even know what a nuke is in the first century. This is a genre that communicates truths in a way that might be unfamiliar to us, but it certainly wasn't unfamiliar to them. The genre of this book, as we mentioned before, is what we can call apocalyptic literature. And it follows normal conventions of the genre, which everyone in the original audience would have been familiar with. The problem is, we're just not familiar with. So how many of you have read before, like, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress before? Okay, how about C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia? Okay, let me ask you what seems like a might be a weird question. Are those stories true? Ah, see, we got mixed responses here, right? Well, if you impose this sort of like misunderstanding of the genre of those books and go, well, is the Chronicles of Narnia giving us like a historical biography akin to like the biography of Abraham Lincoln or something? Well, the answer to that is obviously no. But is it doing something? Is Lewis doing something with the symbols of Aslan and Narnia that are telling something true? Absolutely. We've got no problem engaging with those kinds of stories, but we would do those stories a disservice if we thought of them the same way we thought of picking up a biography of Abraham Lincoln. It's not intended to tell the same thing. And so John the Revelator, what is he doing? Is he giving us a biography of Abraham Lincoln or something like that? No, this is much more akin to Pilgrim's Progress or Narnia, except that it's inspired text. Now, maybe you're asking, okay, so just as a brief aside, like, how did we come to read this book so strangely? How did I come to believe as a young kid this had something to do with me not making it to 20 years old? Why did we come to conclude that this was primarily about current event predictions? And it's not nefarious. So if you grew up and maybe this is kind of the way you learned the story, I want to just tell you, encourage you, like, you don't have to be bitter with the people that did that and explained it to you that way. They were doing the best that they can. But just as a sheer matter of history, apocalyptic literature as a genre was common in the first century. And then for various reasons that I won't bore you with today, it kind of fell out of fashion. People stopped writing in those conventions. Similar to, I mean, how many of you grew up at a time in which every TV show and every movie was a Western? And then it kind of fell out of fashion for a bit, right? I mean, there's still Westerns, but it's not everywhere. And the same thing for apocalyptic literature. So the people in the first century reading this go, we get this, you know, we understand this. But then it fell out of fashion. And for the longest time, most people didn't have access to other apocalyptic books other than books like Revelation or Daniel. So they didn't understand how to read it. And then, just as a matter of history, there was a few discoveries of some other texts in the 18th century, and then the big treasure trove was when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947. And in the Dead Sea Scroll treasure trove, they found hundreds of fragments of various apocalyptic stories. And that gave scholars the ability, which has only been in the last few decades, and decoding this stuff takes a lot of time. That's given scholars the ability to realize, oh my goodness, now we can better understand this genre. So, you know, if you grew up and you heard, like, Revelation is primarily like a current event prediction thing, people were probably trying to do the best that they could with the information that we have. But now, just as a matter of practical historical scholarship, we have better information. And now we know how to engage that text in a way that's much more like what the original audience was like and understood. So as Pastor Jay mentioned last week, it's a mistake to make the Apocalypse of John, what we call the Book of Revelation, primarily about future predictions. What it is primarily doing is using symbolic language to talk about, we could say, three spheres of reality. And this is common not just to books like Revelation, but you can see this across various apocalyptic books that aren't even in the canon of Scripture. What are they doing? First of all, they're talking about ultimate reality. So it's a description in symbolic terms of that which goes way beyond our ability in language and picture to understand ultimate reality. And it also describes ultimate reality. We can kind of see this in the picture. Ultimate reality is that which is above everything. And then below that, you have this cosmic struggle between forces of light and darkness, between the side that is oriented to the true picture of ultimate reality, the one that wants to properly order reality in alignment with who's on the throne of ultimate reality, and then the forces of darkness, which are moving against that, bringing disorder. And then below that, in all of this, I mean, this is just part of the cosmology of these first century people. Then below that, you have the affairs of mankind. And the affairs of mankind, you have to understand, this is a very different way than we usually think about this stuff. The affairs of mankind are largely driven and determined by the outcome of what happens in that cosmic struggle. That's how people thought of the world. It's foreign to us in some ways, but it was common for them. So in the apocalyptic stories, you see a picture of these three spheres: ultimate reality, a cosmic struggle in the heavens, in the affairs of mankind. And so the affairs of mankind are influenced, but here's an interesting thing that we also see in these stories. Humanity can also affect what happens in that cosmic struggle. You see in this story, like Revelation and other apocalyptic stories, you see typically this pattern of a human agent, someone in the affairs of mankind, getting lifted up out of the affairs of humanity. And they get brought up into ultimate reality and to see the cosmic struggle between light and darkness, good and evil, angelic and demonic forces. They get a picture of that. Now, if you're hearing this and you're going, boy, that's a really, really strange way to think, strange way of telling stories. Actually, we still do this all the time. You know, I often take in and watch a number of things that are kind of happening in pop culture, not because I enjoy them, but because I'm a bit of a cultural theologian and I enjoy studying this stuff. And so I am certainly, whenever I bring up a reference to a movie or show, I'm not giving a pastoral endorsement on it, okay, just be clear. But kind of in the zeitgeist over the last few weeks, and actually over the last few years, has been this really popular series called Stranger Things, right? And again, not a stamp of approval here, but it was interesting over the last couple of weeks. I saw this image where people are trying to wrestle with the cosmology of Stranger Things. And it's just an illustration of how these stories are actually not that foreign to us. This is a show about a peaceful town where the affairs of mankind are completely disrupted by a cosmic darkness, which brings what they literally call the upside down. It flips upside down all the goodness of their peaceful little town and demonically corrupts the affairs of mankind. And the only way for that little town of Hawkins to be set right is for what they call, literally call this in the show, the right side up to happen. They have to step into the cosmic struggle, defeat that prince of darkness. And look, I saw this week. I'm, again, not an endorsement of the show, but I'm just telling you, this kind of stuff in Revelation isn't actually that foreign to us. Look at this. I mean, this is literally like a cosmology of Stranger Things, and it is pretty much the same picture that they were grasping with and wrestling with in the first century in apocalyptic literature. The little town of Hawkins being disrupted by demonic forces, and they have to go up, defeat that darkness and ultimate reality. This isn't actually a story that's that odd to us. We just have to get the conventions with it. And so in the Apocalypse of John, I want to set for you what we'll be talking about throughout this series, but especially this week and next week, as the struggle that's taking place in that cosmic layer in the heavens between what we will call Team Lamb versus Team Dragon. Team Lamb versus Team Dragon. This is the struggle that's unfolding. It's primarily a cosmic struggle that we get to participate in and play some role in. And in the beginning of Revelation, John, his upward journey to seeing the unveiling of God's plan for how that gap between ultimate reality, the way it should be, and what's happening in the affairs of humankind, how does that gap get closed? That's a better way of thinking of it. Not so much future predictions, but we have a gap between ultimate reality and the way things are right now. And God gives John a picture of how this gap gets closed. So think of it more like this movement instead of like this movement. Is there a future component? Absolutely. But it's closing that gap. And I want you to see this because this is really cool. How does Team Lamb win? How does things finally get set right side up? Let's begin in Revelation chapter 1 here together. And I want to start off at verse 10. You can follow along with me on the screen or in your own Bible. On the Lord's day, I was in the Spirit, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet, which said, "Write on a scroll what you see, and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamum, to Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea." I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and among the lampstands was someone like the Son of Man, dressed in a robe, reaching down to his feet with a golden sash around his chest. The hair on his head was white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp, double-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in all its brilliance. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. Then he placed his right hand on me and said, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades." It has not been said explicitly by name, but who has John just encountered at the beginning of the story? There you go. It's the easy Sunday school answer to everything, right? He's encountered a vision of Christ. And what's interesting about the start of John's apocalypse, which sets it apart from many other non-biblical apocalyptic stories, is that John is not immediately brought up into the heavens, into ultimate reality. But instead, the one who governs and sits enthroned in ultimate reality comes down to him first. It's important. Now, we're not going to unpack all the symbolism here of all the lampstands, but I want to highlight one of them. We see this interesting image of this Son of Man, one like the Son of Man, who's got seven stars in his right hand. And you go, seven, right? We see that in scriptures a lot, of course, the 7 days of creation. Why seven stars? We got to step into the ancient Near Eastern world for a moment to fully appreciate what's happening here. You see, in the ancient world, we've got so much light pollution that we miss out on the stars and seeing the constellations at night. But if you've ever been up north, you get a little glimpse, you know, where there's less light pollution of what the ancient world experienced all the time in even greater measure. The night sky was filled with bright stars. They could see constellations. They could look up and see the Milky Way galaxy. And these constellations moved in predictably fixed patterns. So with no light pollution, you could look up at the night sky and see a constellation in the shape of a lion called Leo. And he would predictably move across the heavens, and when Leo hung over your town, it was summertime. And when Leo would move, there would be a new season. And so these ancient people associated the constellations in the sky as powers themselves, dictating their day-to-day lives and the seasons. But up in the sky, they also noticed while the constellations moved in predictable patterns, there were a few heavenly bodies that they called wanderers, which is actually where we get the word planets from. They would have seen them as stars. They wouldn't have known them as planetary bodies. But they saw seven wandering features in the night sky. And in much of Babylonian astrology and the world of the ancient Near East, those seven wandering planets, those stars, became associated with gods themselves. You know, we're familiar, if you know anything about ancient astrology or pagan mythology, you know, for example, like Zeus is associated with the planet Jupiter, right? The Romans called Zeus Jupiter. When we look up in the sky, we see a heavenly body. It moves on its own. It looks like it acts like it has its own mind. And so for many of the original audience's neighbors, that is what the world was like that they lived in. And they assigned powers in the night sky to those stars, those wandering stars. But here we have the Son of Man, who in his right hand holds all the powers of the heavens. It's under his control. See, they thought in the night sky, various gods, gods of your neighbors, were warring against each other. And you might be caught up in the collision of that, not knowing if your neighbor's gods were more powerful than your gods. But here we have the God of Israel, in the God-man Jesus Christ, and in his right hand, he is holding it all together. It's a powerful picture. So this arena for this cosmic battle that's taking place between principalities and powers in their mind, Christ is like, I got this under control. He's holding it in his right hand. And this becomes, even later we see at the end of Revelation 1, him saying, you know what? You can see those stars in the sky. You know what? This is all in my right hand. And they're like angels. They're like messengers to the seven churches. They're under my control. So John, hey, the one who's really in charge here, you need to take heart because it's not Zeus. It's not Baal. It's not any of these other gods your neighbors are worshiping. The one who triumphed over death and the power of Hades, you know, you could kind of think of that as the upside down world. The one who triumphed over that is me, and I'm going to unveil how the world is set right. So we're actually going to circle back at the end of our sermon series to see the specific messages that God, through Christ and through John, gives to those seven churches. But let's jump ahead to Revelation 4 here for our next snapshot to get introduced to why we're calling this Team Lamb. So you can jump ahead to Revelation 4. Whoops, went too far back there. After this, I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven, and the voice I first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this. At once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it, and the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and ruby. A rainbow that shone like an emerald encircled the throne. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seated on them were 24 elders. They were dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning, rumblings, and peals of thunder. In front of the throne, seven lamps were blazing. These are the seven spirits of God. Also, in front of the throne, there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal. In the center, around the throne, were four living creatures, and they were covered with eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion. The second was like an ox. The third had the face like a man. The fourth was like a flying eagle. Each of the four living creatures had six wings and was covered with eyes all around, even under its wings. Day and night, they never stopped saying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come. Whenever the living creatures give glory, honor, and thanks to him who sits on the throne and who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who sits on the throne and worships him who lives forever and ever. They lay their crowns before the throne and say, you are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being. There's lots of numbers and symbols here. We could take years to unpack each one of them, and I will draw your attention to one that is consistent with what we saw in chapter 1. Around the throne, we have these weird things called the living creatures. One looks like a lion, one looks like an ox, one has the face of the man, one looks like an eagle. It's weird, right? Not to the original audience. Once again, these are common symbols in that ancient world and cosmology. You could see, this is John actually hearkening back to these same symbols in Ezekiel chapter 1. What do they mean? It kind of goes back to this ancient cosmology, the war in the heavens. The lion. The lion is a symbol of Leo. We have these different constellation symbols. When the lion is overhead in the summer, it's the summer heat. When the ox or the bull, the constellation that looks like that, is overhead, it's spring and the season of fertility. When the man or Aquarius is overhead, it's the rainy season of winter for them. When the eagle, which kind of got rebranded from the scorpion, they thought the scorpion was not positive branding, so they rebranded it as the eagle. When that constellation was overhead, it was the season of death in the fall. But notice here, unlike their other pagan neighbors, these heavenly creatures aren't worshipped. You don't give worship to the stars in the sky. They are giving worship to the one seated on the throne. The cosmic order in their world, the thing that brought about all the seasons, there's a corrective picture here. They are not to be worshipped. They're not in control. In fact, these seasons, these signs in the sky, they bow down before the one who's enthroned on the throne of ultimate reality. But who is on the throne? So far, we haven't had an explicit picture. John hasn't unveiled the identity of who's on the throne. We know he's called the Lord and God by the cosmic powers that bow before him. For this answer, we need to just turn over to chapter 5. So turn over to chapter 5 here, starting at verse 2, and we get the identity of the one who's enthroned. Revelation 5, verse 2, "And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?' But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals.'" What is the scroll here? The scroll is the symbol of the story of history in this present age, which ends when the cosmic struggle is finally set right and the affairs of mankind down here come into alignment with ultimate reality. That is how the story ends. But there's a problem that makes John weep. Who's worthy to finish this story? Who's worthy to bridge the gap, to bring the affairs of humankind, our day-to-day lives, the struggles of the nations and politics? Who's the one that's worthy to set that right and bring it into alignment? John weeps. It's like, who could possibly do that job? That seems impossible. Who's worthy in the cosmic heavens or the domain of the affairs of humanity to finish the story? It's the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David. In messianic language, it's a clear picture of Christ. He triumphed. And onto the scene next, in this very next snapshot, onto the scene of ultimate reality, a new image emerges. Take a look here at verse 6. In that same chapter, what does John see next? "Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. The lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures bowed, and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. And they sang a new song, saying, 'You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals. Because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." If you look at your handout or on the screen here, you'll see a picture, an artistic rendering. It's trying to capture what John sees here. Who is seated on the throne? In the picture, we kind of have it presented in kind of in front of the throne, but it's really in John's picture. It is the Lamb, a slain Lamb, sits enthroned as the King, governing all the cosmos of ultimate reality itself. The temptation for each one of us, just as it was for those living in immense persecution, political turmoil, nations raging, none of that stuff changes. The end is always nigh. The same temptation they faced is what we face today, is to believe that in a world where we see so much darkness still, that whoever killed the Lamb is what's really in charge. Isn't that one of the first questions that would enter your head? I see a slain Lamb. It'd be pretty natural to think that whoever killed the Lamb is who's really in charge, right? But that's not the picture that we have, church. There's a paradox here. It's not who killed the Lamb, but the Lamb is victorious. The slain Lamb is who sits on the throne. He's not even just like a special agent next to the throne, positioned along other angels. You'll notice here those four, Leo, the ox, they bow down before the Lamb too. He is on the throne. Christ is Lord, true God of true God, one with the Father. Why is he worthy to set the world right? Because he was slain. The gap between ultimate reality and our present moment, even right now, which we can see, we can look around all the time, whether it's right here in South Minneapolis, whether it's affairs going on all over the world, whether it's in your own household, we experience this tension between living in an age where we go, there's still darkness. So the gap between ultimate reality, that picture of everything set right, and our present moment, which is not fully set right, how is that closed? It is the same way. This is the for us part of Revelation. The to us was all of that imagery. The for us on this is the way that gets closed is the same way it always gets closed, by living in the way of Jesus. Those that live in his way, when you live in his way, you are on Team Lamb. Those that do that cooperate in his final triumph over darkness. Pastor Jay next week is going to talk about Team Dragon and that those forces of darkness. But I want to give one final biblical snapshot here to just show you again. This is how we overcome, church. Revelation 12. We'll talk more about this in future weeks, but I couldn't leave you without this picture because this is what gives us hope, right? Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. That cosmic struggle, right? But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. They triumphed over him." Pay attention to this. How did they triumph over him? By the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. For that original audience living in apocalyptic times, in the apocalypse of John, they lived in a world where it seemed like dark principalities and powers, the nations and empires with their allegiances to wandering stars and fallen gods like Zeus and Jupiter. There was a temptation to believe that they were the ones that were really in charge. Because wasn't those powers the one that killed the Lamb? They were persecuted, alienated from their surrounding culture. They didn't fit in. They lived quite literally under the fear of death for their allegiance to Christ and the Lamb. Their consolation, just to get this right, their consolation wasn't, well, 2,000 years from now, you know, the U.S. is going to beat the Soviets in the Cold War. That's not the message for them. Their consolation and hope was that the Lamb had already won. That was ultimate reality. I'm not going to get into all, you know, general relativity and quantum mechanics or anything like that, but there's a sense in which our perception as time-bound creatures don't get the layers of reality that transcend us. The Lamb is already enthroned. It is finished. Their consolation was that hope. And so how did that get closed for them? By living faithfully to the way of the Lamb. In the day in and day out of their lives, in their participation in Christ, that's how darkness is defeated. That's how darkness loses. And one day, the future component, the future hope is this, even if we don't see it in our life, church, that even as this gap closes, and some of us, I made it past 20, thankfully, right? I don't know when or how the story is going to end. Nobody does, and anybody that tells you otherwise is mistaken. Nobody knows how this gap gets closed. Predictions and speculation might be fun, but the living hope that we have is that it gets closed and things will finally be set right. The only thing we know is how to participate in the closing of that gap. So here's the tricky part about Revelation. And I'll close with this as the worship team comes back up. The tricky part about Revelation is oftentimes, like, we want really solid practical applications. Right? Like, read a proverb every day, right? You know, Proverbs is great, giving you practical applications for how you should handle your finances and business, and we kind of want every book to do that, but sorry, this isn't the book for that. Actually, it's doing something more important. Instead of practical applications, the focus of Revelation is about proper orientation. Are you aimed in the right direction? And so the proper orientation for our hearts, for our eyes, in the midst of whatever we're going through, whether this week you're like, my marriage is barely hanging on by a thread, or whether you're here somewhere in South Minneapolis where your neighborhood once again has been turned upside down, what do you do? I mean, we can talk about tons of range of possible practical applications, but we will get that wrong if our orientation isn't right. Our orientation is look up. Eyes up. Don't get caught up here. The affairs of mankind, even this cosmic spiritual struggle that we all are, there's a Lamb enthroned above it all. Orientation, upward, upward, look up. So when you're stuck in the swirl of the messes and the affairs of mankind, look up. You feel like a cosmic spiritual struggle is raging all around you, look up. So they missed their cue. When the worship team comes back up, yeah. I want to invite you now to actually stand and to orient our hearts upward, and we can all stand here together now. The best practical application I can give you right now for whatever you're going through is to look up right now and see the one enthroned over all.